Good morning, everyone. I hope you didn't have a terrible time getting here this morning. It's first snow. And first case, 08-12-28, 08-22-54, Chow versus Kern Development. And it's Mr. Berglund, is it?
Yes, it is.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Joseph Berglund, representing the defendants, Kern Development Corporation, and George Klein, Jr. George Klein was removed as trustee of a plan that had already been terminated, without a hearing. According to a consent decree that was entered into and drafted by the Department of Labor and approved by the trial court, George Klein was ordered to and did terminate the Kern Development Corporation's pension plans.
You know, I'd like to ask you sort of a bottom line question about the evidentiary hearing, because, you know, you've said that an evidentiary hearing was required on really a number of matters. Did you ever make known to Judge Schenker your view that an evidentiary matter was necessary, that an evidentiary hearing was necessary?
Judge, we did not. We didn't think it was necessary to do so. Under the law, it's an abuse of discretion for a trial court to decide disputed issues of fact without holding an evidentiary hearing.
Isn't it true that the key facts were undisputed?
The key facts were not undisputed. The question is whether George Klein acted in good faith.
Well, I realize that you disputed the court's conclusion from the facts that he breached his fiduciary duty to the beneficiaries of the trust, but the actual key facts, they were undisputed, it seems to me.
Some of the facts were not in dispute, whereas others were. One of the important facts that were in dispute is whether this proposed installment contract that was submitted by the Village of Westmont after they terminated the contract changed the deal, which we believe and asserts it completely changed the deal that the Village of Westmont had for the purchase of the property. Another issue is whether the Village could close. If the Village had the money to close, they wouldn't have had to terminate the contract when they did. And in their termination letter, they offer a myriad of reasons underlying their failure to close on the purchase of the property. What was George Klein to do? If he had used a higher number to cash out the participants, he would have been left holding the bag if the property didn't sell to the Village of Westmont. He was in a catch-22. We believe that George Klein should have been given, at least afforded, a hearing. There were factual issues, and these were issues of material facts, and that the trial court proceeded to resolve them based upon a declaration submitted by the Village of Westmont's attorney, John Zemanek, who was a biased individual. Even assuming the trial court was correct in finding that there was a breach, we believe that the remedy was also incorrect. The trial court imposed a constructive trust on the entire property, not just on George Klein's interest, but on the interest of the other participants who chose to receive an ownership interest in the property.
What percentage of the property belonged to him?
A little over 29%.
After all the smoke cleared
away. I'm sorry, it's 60, a little over 67%.
That's better.
67. And his wife had approximately 30%, and the third participant had about a little under 3%.
So he and his wife had 97%.
Correct. And there was no wrongdoing alleged or found on behalf of his wife. And this third party, as well as his wife, were never given the opportunity to come to court and be heard. They were never given that opportunity.
Well, go ahead.
I was going to say, why, if you talked about this being a catch-22, if it was, why isn't it resolvable by Klein by saying, it's our my view, it's worth $1.7 million, but offer there's an offer to purchase by the city for $2.3 million. We don't think that's the appropriate value. We put 1.7. Just put that option out there so that there'd be a full disclosure.
Oh, is your question more about the disclosure aspect as opposed to cashing out the participants?
Right, yeah. Because I would think that some people might have been more inclined to take an interest in the property if they thought it was going to be chance it would be valued at significantly more than $1.7 million.
See, I believe that's a burden that the plaintiff has to prove. If these participants were advised, here's the purchase price,
but
you have accepted an ownership interest in land based upon this purchase offer made by the Village of Westmont?
Thank God Judge Evans doesn't have to decide that.
So George Klein used the most objective piece of material available to him, and it was the appraisal.
Look, why wasn't he required to, at the very least, disclose the offer he had received from the village? You know, I know that your view is that the plan participants would only have been interested in the amount of money that they were to receive, and that it's irrelevant as to whether or not he communicated the offer. But didn't the offer suggest that the appraised value that he used to calculate the distributions was too low? And so arguably, wasn't he pursuing his own interests by keeping these sales negotiations totally, completely?
Well, he didn't complete the negotiations totally to himself. On August 30th, 2005, he did offer to the village to reinstate the contract with a closing date of September 15th, 2005. So if the village accepted his offer to reinstate the contract, he could have used the sales proceeds and then cashed everybody out at that purchase price. The $1.7 million appraisal is certainly lower than the purchase price offered by the Village of Westmont. The Village of Westmont held the key to zoning.
I just can't get past something, and it's this. You can look at it sort of, you know, two ways. One way would be that by keeping the negotiations for sale to himself at a sale price significantly in excess of the appraised value, that he was displaying a gross self-interest. And at a minimum, you can view it as having deprived the beneficiaries of material information. It seems to me he should have disclosed it. And that's why the court removed him from his position, because he failed to do that.
Well, the village also threatened to condemn the property. Property is, especially as we know in today's economy, it's volatile. You know, one day it can be worth X amount number of dollars, the next day it can be worth something completely different.
Yeah, but that really wasn't the case back in 2006.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. But there's no evidence that had this disclosure been made, any particular participant would have changed his election to choose property.
Wouldn't there be a presumption if you thought you could make more money if you accepted the one proposition that you'd take it?
I don't think so, because if you choose...
Turn down money that you think it's almost in the bag.
Well, not really. If you choose property over money, property...
Well, shouldn't you be at least have the option of deciding which you're going to do by having full information?
I think you should.
Good.
And I don't think that the deprivation of this information affected their decision to choose property versus cash.
Look, all beneficiaries, all in any kind of situation, have an interest in an accurate valuation of property at its true worth. And here, the true worth was higher. And that was kept from these people. And that's a very high mountain for you to climb.
Well, it was worth a certain amount to the village of Westmont, who showed they couldn't close on the purchase. And there was an appraisal that was done within the prior year, which showed the property was worth a lot less. And then there was an appraisal done shortly after the village terminated the contract, and that appraisal came in at $1.8 million. But notwithstanding, even if there had been a breach, the court shouldn't have imposed a constructive trust on the entire property. There was another participant who wasn't related to George Klein, and he did choose the property. I think that itself evidences that a participant, for various reasons, will make a decision whether to choose property or cash. Cash, you get, it's immediate. You get it right away. Property, you might not get for years down the road. Another issue that we raised on appeal is the court's approval of the distributions made as a result of the revised calculations submitted by the independent fiduciary. The court had ordered the independent fiduciary to recalculate the distributions using $1.7 million as the value of the property and to include a credit in the revised calculations for a distribution that had been made to a participant, Ken Arneson, for a little over $69,000. Well, the independent fiduciary went above and beyond the trial court's order. In revising its calculations, they included an additional $143,151.83.
I have to tell you, I wanted to ask both parties that I have to confess to some confusion about the nature of this payment, because the parties seem to be entirely at odds about what this payment represents, and I would really appreciate, you know, you telling me your view. I know that you suggest that the district court was misled on this subject, you know, in your reply brief.
Yes.
But if you could help me understand what that's about, and then all of you over there, one by one, to explain to me what this is all about.
Judge, and plaintiff's appendix 182, there's a column called Recognized Sales Proceeds Used to Pay Distributions from Second Mortgage.
Did you say 182?
Yes, plaintiff's appendix 182. It's the second from last column. And the total is $143,151.83. If you take that number out of their revised calculations, other participants will get less money. This money was put into the pot and allocated amongst everybody. It was taken out of George Klein's account. The plaintiff indicates, well, it was just there for demonstrative purposes. But if you do the physical calculations and take that column out, the numbers change. It's not there just for demonstrative purposes. Initially, George Klein had taken out a loan for about $200,000 because there wasn't enough cash to pay all the participants. And he used $143,000 of that loan to make payments to participants. The court, contrary to the plaintiff's, the Department of Labor's recommendation, found that that should not be included in the calculations. Yet here it is. They put it back in. Another issue that we raised on appeal is prejudgment interest. The court averaged the prime rate, came out to 6.67%. We submitted the actual rate of return, which is a lot lower than 6.67%, in the form of a declaration from Ken Arneson. The purpose of awarding prejudgment interest to participants is to make them whole, not to penalize the trustee.
But you see, you didn't object to the rate until the motion for reconsideration, as I understand it.
That is correct. We initially objected to the imposition of any prejudgment interest. And we filed a motion to reconsider objecting to the rate, and the judge denied our motion without any rationale.
I have to stop you now because your red light is on.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is it Mr. Silverman?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, can you answer some of the questions that we have?
Some of them, hopefully. All of them. May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Silverman, representing the appellee in this case, the Secretary of Labor, chiefly addressing Klein's removal as trustee, the imposition of a constructive trust, and the prejudgment interest rate set by the district court. My co-counsel will be addressing Klein's illegal use of plan assets for corporate purposes, such as your question regarding the $143,000 for corporate purposes. Excuse me. This case is simple, Your Honors. George Klein, a trustee.
It's always simple for the lawyer. It's unbelievable. I spent all of Friday reading it.
I assure you, Your Honor, this case is simple. George Klein, a trustee, violated his duty of loyalty to participants by trying to cheat the participants out of over $600,000 of their plan assets. Those actions stem from over a decade of mismanagement by George Klein, acting as trustee for his company's employee benefit plans. The Secretary initially filed an action against George Klein, an administrative action, for his failure to mail participants their plan statements. As in defending himself against that action, George Klein used plan assets to pay his own legal bills. As a result of those expenditures, the Secretary filed a second claim against George Klein, which resulted in the entry of a consent decree requiring Klein to terminate the plans in compliance with ERISA. Those plans' assets included a partial property, the Westmont property, to which each of the participants could lay claim through their respective shares in the plan's assets. It is therefore important for this court to keep in mind that Klein was operating in the post-consent decree context, and that his actions in this case represent a continuation of his treatment of plan assets like his own piggy bank. It was not necessary for the district court to hold an evidentiary hearing because there are no material factual disputes. Klein's alleged factual disputes amount to good faith arguments, which this court has long held is irrelevant and not a defense to a breach of a duty of loyalty. The material facts are uncontested. George Klein, a real estate developer by trade, had the Village of Westmont property appraised for $1.7 million. He thereafter, in the same time period, received multiple offers for $2.3 million from the Village of Westmont for that property. In subsequent communications with trustees, in his capacity as, sorry, communications with the participants, in his capacity as trustee, supposedly acting in their best interest, he informed them about the $1.7 million valuation but never, ever disclosed any of the $2.3 million offers. In addition, disclosing those offers, Klein rejected all of those offers and instead cast out the participants using the $1.7 million valuation. In doing so, he attempted to illegally transfer the difference between the appraised value, $1.7 million, and the Village of Westmont's offer, $2.3 million, that difference being $600,000 from the plan's assets to his own accounts. On January 5, 2006, nearly 3 years ago, the district court, on the basis of these undisputed facts, found that Klein breached his duty of loyalty under Section 404 of ERISA. Klein now attempts to appeal this three-year-old order, even though that order, like most post-judgment orders, was final and appealable when issued and is no longer reviewable by this court. That order was final and appealable under this court's precedent because it resolved all the issues raised in the Secretary's motion seeking liability and remedies against Klein. As such, this court lacks jurisdiction to review Klein's removal as trustee and the imposition of a constructive trust because Klein's appeal is untimely under both the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure and the common law doctrine of lapses. In any event, the law in this case is simple. ERISA Section 404 codifies the duty of loyalty, which is the highest duty known to law and requires the fiduciary to act solely in the interest of participants. The Supreme Court in Verity v. Howe said that that duty of loyalty carries with it a duty to communicate honestly with participants, and that the failure to do so is a breach. This court went further in Annweiler and later in Bowerman to say that the fiduciary duty of loyalty includes a duty to communicate material facts, that is, facts that affect the interests of participants, to participants, whether or not they ask. Despite the clear law on the duty of loyalty and the facts that I described earlier, Klein's briefs alarmingly suggest that the duty of loyalty is a red herring in this case. In actuality, Klein's manipulation of the Westmont property in an effort to illegally transfer assets from his participants' retirement savings to his own account is a clear demonstration of a breach of loyalty.
How many participants exercise the cash-only option?
Excuse me? I couldn't hear you.
As I understand it, everybody except one person took the cash option.
Correct.
All the participants. How many are there?
37 total former participants. That includes George Klein and Elaine Klein.
And then the one person who didn't took a kind of a combination of cash and a...
Yes. The consent decree, Your Honor, actually gives two options. The option is cash or cash and property. So 34 chose cash, and 3 chose the cash and property option, or cash
and
or property.
And 3 includes Mr.
And
Klein
and 2 to 3
his
being
wife.
Klein, the 3rd being an individual, Michael Malewski, who took a 3% stake in the property.
Okay.
And putting aside the legal irrelevance of Klein's good faith assertion, it is inconceivable how Klein could factually argue that he was acting in good faith when he was simultaneously lying to participants about the value of the plan's assets and treating their retirement savings as his own trust fund. There is no dispute that the consent decree ordered Klein to terminate the plans in compliance with ERISA. As such, the consent decree ordered Klein to communicate honestly with participants regarding the value of the plan and to completely and fully distribute to the participants the full value of their share in the plans. Your Honor, contrary to Klein's assertion, none of the election options altered the size of the distribution to which they were entitled to. This is the heart of the argument, that somehow by electing to receive those distribution in the form of cash or cash and property, that the participants were potentially altering the size of their distribution. If I have a 25% stake in a plan, and I elect to receive that 25% stake in the form of cash, property, or widgets, after making that decision, I still have a 25% stake in the plan, regardless of how I've chosen to receive it or the form I've chosen to receive it in. A trustee, Klein in this case, could not unilaterally or of his own accord alter that hypothetical 25% interest, or in this case, the interest of the participant, based on the form they chose to receive those distributions in. Especially, as in this case, where the alteration or the allocation was to his own accounts. Klein does not dispute in any way, his intention to keep the property, the 97% interest in the property, along with his wife, as part of his course of conduct. And so he does not in any way dispute his attempted illegal transfer of plan assets to his own account. As a result of this conduct, the district court imposed a constructive trust over the property to protect the legitimate interests of all the participants. The secretary's claim was filed under Section 502A2 of ERISA, which provides for claims against fiduciaries whose actions cause a loss to the plan. Klein was the only individual named as a defendant. The secretary represented the legitimate interest of all the participants in the property, which is through their respective shares in the plan's assets, and has in no way impaired those interests through the imposition of a constructive trust. And finally, Your Honor, the prejudgment interest rate set by the district court should be affirmed. The 6.67% rate set by the district court is the federal rate for the underpayment of corporate income taxes, and is nearly identical to the prime rate over the same period of time, which is 6.6%, which this court has suggested the district courts use as a reference point. As such, the district court was well within its discretion to set the rate at 6.67%, and its decision was consistent with the policy objectives behind prejudgment interest, such as preventing unjust enrichment and deterring undue compliance with court orders. For the foregoing reasons, we respectfully request this court to affirm in full the district court decision below.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Silverman.
My co-counsel will be speaking.
Mr. Masney.
Mr. Holtzman. This is Arthur Holtzman.
Sorry. Mr. Holtzman.
Still on the side of the... May it please the court.
It's Monday after a holiday.
Understood, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor. Arthur Holtzman on behalf of the court-appointed independent fiduciary. Your Honor, going to the perhaps most interesting of the panel question, the $143,151.83.
Certainly the most mysterious.
I will try to shed some light on it, Your Honor. The independent fiduciary in calculating the restorative payments, as the court knows, the independent fiduciary comes in, and now the property's been sold for a greater amount of money than Mr. Klein had it. And we argued to the court that that delta, that differential, should be distributed to all the former participants, not just those who elected property, because they didn't know what the property was worth. And so we originally, or through our accountant, the independent fiduciary used a value of $1.5 million as the basis and was going to make the delta, the incremental payment, with a basis pro rata of the 1.5. District Court ruled against us and said we had to use the 1.7 because there was that $143,000 which was borrowed on the property by Mr. Klein and distributed. So what that column is, it restores the $143,000 to all the participants who got the money, so that the basis for determining the pro rata distribution is not based upon the 1.5 that our accountant originally used, but is based upon that 1.7. It's not money taken from Mr. Klein's account. It was money that had already been distributed, but we had to use that as the basis because the court ordered us to do that. So then you start out then with a basis of 1.7, and because the property sold for 2.5, now you determine the pro rata interest. You would say, Judge Rovner, your interest is X dollars. You have X percent of the plan, and you will then get X percent of that delta, that roughly $800,000.
You say the money had already been distributed. What did you do? Go and get it back?
No. We just didn't put it in the basis. We were doing a redistribution. We are doing restorative payments. We are saying, as if the plan still was in effect, we understand the plan was terminated, but relying upon IRS rulings, other rulings, we said because there had been wrongdoing, all the former participants that we could find should get the benefit of the increased value of the property. The property is sold by the independent fiduciary for $2.5, not $1.7, not $2.3, but $2.5. So that huge increase, had Mr. Klein held it, presumably he and his wife would have kept that delta, that differential. We took it and argued to the court that the difference should be distributed pro rata to all of the former participants, that we were going to use a former basis, a former baseline, whatever we say was in your account. Well, we, again, wanted to use 1.5, and the court said we had to use 1.7. So by using 1.7, we have to give you credit for that distribution Mr. Klein made, and that's the base amount. So that, to use an easy example, if we had $1 million and your account has $100,000 in it, Judge Rovner, then you get 10% of the delta. If we had said that you only had $50,000, you would have gotten a smaller amount. So your basis, each of the former participants, is important for the independent fiduciary to know about to make the distribution of the delta, the differential. It was not money taken out of Mr. Klein's account, and that's why we said you can't show a number that it came from Mr. Klein. It was an accounting matter that said we had to start with a higher basis to then make the reallocation of the differential using the $2.5 million. What the independent fiduciary is doing is taking the profit, that money, when it sold, when the independent fiduciary sold the Westmont property, and regardless of whether you or anybody else had asked for only cash or cash and property, we're giving everybody the same benefit. We're saying you didn't know what was involved, and therefore, you know, when you got your letter from the independent fiduciary, if not a windfall, it's good news to you. You may have thought you already were cashed out, but you weren't, because by court order you're getting money and you can roll it over tax-free. Your Honor, there was a question raised about the authority, at least in the briefs, of the independent fiduciary. And if you go back to when the Consulting Fiduciaries, Inc., the independent fiduciary, is named, the court said it shall carry out its fiduciary duties in accordance with the requirements of ERISA and in the best interests of the plan participants. Independent fiduciary took that charge by the district court quite seriously. We started investigating, and we found things that did not make sense. And over a course of many, many months, there were letters, emails to the defendants from the independent fiduciary, from me, from counsel, from others, asking questions. What does this mean? What's the support for this? So there was ample opportunity to answer the questions that were ultimately posed in that Crouch-Hizik report, which became the basis of the challenges to some of the payments. If I may finish, Your Honor, the district court then said in November 22nd, I think this is important, in order to calculate how the proceeds from the sale should be distributed, we agree that CFI, the independent fiduciary, may investigate whether other funds have been improperly withdrawn from the ERISA trust, and thus whether the distribution of the sale proceeds should be adjusted to correct for any earlier improper withdrawals. That's exactly what the independent fiduciary did. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holtzman. Now, Mr. Mastny.
May it please the Court, Ken Mastny on behalf of defendants. A couple of issues that were questions that came up, just to clarify, there wasn't 30 participants that had this option to choose between land and property. I believe it was 9 participants. 30 received distributions, but they went back quite a few years, and the majority of these participants were no longer in the plan. So a lot of people were receiving distributions for money that was paid back for improper expenses in the past. So this isn't an issue of 3 on one side, 34 on the other. It's 3 on one side, 6 on the other. And I don't know if that, from a practical standpoint, I think it matters just when you're looking at it. It's not as gross as it seems. In regard to the $143,000 distribution, I understand appellee's side no more now than I did before. I don't understand the delta. From our point of view, the delta is the $700,000, which was the difference between the sale price of the land and the $1.7 million appraisal, which is what the court ruled how the calculation should have been made. From our point of view, they added in that $143,000, and our point of view is also that when all is said and done, the objective of the restorative payments and the distribution of the sales proceeds is to make the participants whole. If all the participants are made whole, then the remaining money would go to George Klein. So any way you look at it, by distributing the $143,000 excess dollars, I honestly think it's just an accounting. I don't understand it. It seems like it's an accounting trick to tie out the numbers, because the judge said use $1.7 million in his order. And then they used 1.7, and then because they didn't accept it, they threw in the other 143,000. Well, that seems like it's in contravention of the judge's instructions.
Because they didn't accept it. Did you just say because they didn't accept it? Did I mishear?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. The lower court, the district court, indicated they tried to use appellees indicated, they tried to use a different number.
1.5.
1.5 instead of 1.7.
Right. And then
they ordered them to use 1.7.
Right.
So they used 1.7, and then they put in the other, they put in the other 143,000 without any, the judge never approved it. And then the judge kind of turned the tables on defendants and indicated it was up to us to show why that wasn't proper, but the judge had never approved that $143,000 additional distribution. And to be clear, the land value, they had to pay off that mortgage when they sold the land. The $143,000 was paid. George Klein had to take out $143,000 from a loan on the property to pay the cash participants. So when the property sold, they had to pay back the mortgage, which I think is the example laid out in the reply brief. That money was already paid out. It's being redistributed. If you look at the numbers, people are getting extra money. So for them to say that it doesn't make a difference, or that it's just a show how it's being redistributed, I don't agree, because there's people who are getting a check for additional money as a result of that $143,000 being put back in there.
Are you maintaining that that's a windfall for those people?
Yes, Your Honor. In addition, in regards to the language of cheating and decades of mismanagement, I think there's a problem in regards to the breach of duty of loyalty, that there was a planned termination. At the time the plan was terminated, certain participants, three out of the nine, chose property or had an interest in property. Six had an interest in cash. I don't think you can ignore the fact that Mr. Klein at that point had a duty to both groups of participants. And plaintiff's position was at one point in the brief that the distribution should have never been done that way. But plaintiffs actually drew up the consent decree, and it was approved by the court. So George Klein was put into this position where he has a group of participants who had an interest in land and a group of participants who had an interest in cash. And he, albeit maybe it should have never been done that way, he did owe a duty to those people who had an interest in the property. And in regard to the offer from the village, it was off the table at the time of the distribution, which is important. And, once bitten, twice shy. Mr. Klein, the village backed out of the previous sale 5 days prior to the sale for environmental reasons, for condemnation proceedings. Or they admitted that they had started investigating condemnation of the property. So to say that the village's offer meant that there was going to be a closing on the property, I think is kind of idealistic, because that might not necessarily go through. They had already backed out once.
But again, I think what we have to keep our eye on is, I mean, I understand, you know, that you think Mr. Klein was put between a rock and a hard place by the, you know, his duties to the beneficiaries who wanted money and those who wanted a share in the property. But what all the beneficiaries really wanted and what they really had an interest in was the accurate valuation of the property at its honest and true value, and that they never got until you came to court.
Well, our position was that, or is, that the disclosure of the value of the property to somebody who's receiving a letter, it's not going to matter. All they care about is dollars and cents. To say that the property is worth whatever they said it was worth, all they know is they're not going to be getting their cash, that it's an illiquid asset, and they wouldn't be receiving their...
No, you certainly aren't arguing the beneficiaries don't have a right to know the real value. Surely.
No, I'm not arguing that at all. I'm arguing that that there's no causation between the any sort of disclosure and the choices made by the participants. Now, maybe Judge Evans' option earlier would have been the proper course of conduct, but at that time there really wasn't. I mean, he could have laid out in a detailed narrative all the things that had happened up to that point, but realistically, he relied upon an appraisal of the property. And what our point is in our briefs is that it shifted from a duty of loyalty to a duty of care. So what this came out to be is there are disputed issues of facts as to the value of the property. And that's really what our point is the issue is it's not – they're looking at it solely as a duty of loyalty. We're looking at it as there was a duty of care, and there were some factual issues about what that property was really worth. And I think there's some mitigating factors as to the decision to use the appraisal price based on the letters and from the village and the village's past conduct. One of the other issues, I don't know if it's been raised yet, was in regards to the restorative payments that were ordered on behalf of some legal payments for Timothy Milsna. The defendants...
Did you say this hasn't been raised yet?
No, it hasn't.
Well, this is rebuttal, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh. What are you rebutting?
I believe there was a general... there was a general referral to the restorative payments where defendants attached a declaration of Tim Milsna, which was basically discounted by the district court without an evidentiary hearing. Even if it's a summary judgment motion, the inferences should have been looked at in favor of the non-movement. So just to sum up, I believe a big issue is $143,000. I still don't understand where their numbers come from. We've looked at it. We've seen a lot of different excuses for it, but we can't pin it down. The way we look at it is that amount should not have been redistributed. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, everyone. Thank you very much to all counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.